Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. It's a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Tonight on Speakers Forum, we'll hear from author Kristen Olson. Several years ago, she was inspired by a chef in Cleveland, Ohio, and her own sense of wonder to write about soil. The result is her new book, The Soil Will Save Us: How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. In it, she sheds light on our understanding of soil and its crucial role in capturing and storing carbon emissions. Olson details how changes in how we farm may hold the key to countering global warming. Kristen Olson is a freelance journalist and author based in Portland. She's written for The New York Times, The Christian Science Monitor, Utney, and Salon. Her books include Stalking the Divine and Kabul Beauty School. Kristen Olson spoke at Elliott Bay Book Company on July 28, 2014. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording.
So people always ask me what interested me in this book and in this topic, and it was a chef. It was a chef back in Cleveland where I lived named Parker Bosley, and he was one of those Alice Water-like innovators. He had wanted to have a restaurant. He grew up on a farm, and he had wanted to have a restaurant of his own at some point. And he had lived in France for a while, and what really interested him in France was how the restaurants always reflected what was growing in the countryside, what was actually fresh and local and all that. So he wanted to have that kind of restaurant. So I wrote about him years ago for Gourmet, and he was just such an interesting guy and an interesting thinker that I stayed in touch with him, and I would always say, hey, what's new? What should I be writing about, or what should I try to be trying to write about? And the last time I asked him that, he said, carbon farming. There's all these farmers who are talking about not paying attention to the crop so much as to the soil, as to this underlying resource that is responsible for, you know, the crop succeeding and the animals being healthy and all that. So I found it so interesting. You know, he was interested in it as a chef. I mean, he had been one of these bizarre kooks, a lot of legislators thought, in Ohio, because here he was a chef, but he was, like, pestering them about farming regulations and stuff like that. And so he was interested in it from the point of view of food, and he really loved farmers and farms, too. But I was really interested in it right away because of the implication about carbon, you know, that if what all these farmers were doing was trying to make healthier soil and get more carbon in the soil, then what did that say about global warming? What did that say about the carbon dioxide in the air? So, you know, just for a variety of reasons, I thought it was like one of the most interesting trends that I had heard about. So I thought I just have to explore this. So, you know, what I developed over the course of doing the research and writing this book was this real sense of wonder about the land. You know, I've always found the land pretty wonderful, and I kind of tend to walk around it in a certain degree of ecstasy when it's beautiful and things are growing and green. But this really was so much more than that. This was having this incredible new sense of wonder about the soil, about everything that goes on under our feet when we're out walking around. I was looking at an article a couple of weeks ago that talked about scientists thinking now, having a number for stars in the sky. They think it's 300 sextillion, and that's 3 with 23 zeros. So that's really a lot of stars, of course. But in the soil, in a tablespoon of healthy soil, there are 6 billion microorganisms. And the number keeps sort of changing and growing as the instruments and the science gets better at trying to figure out at being able to pinpoint what's there. But 6 billion, that's amazing. So that would sort of mean that in a city like Seattle, there's more microorganisms in the soil than there are stars in the sky. It's staggering. And they're not just in the top couple of inches of soil. You know, we always are told that it's, you know, really the good soil is the stuff that's on the top. But, you know, they certainly are in the top 5 to 6 inches of soil, but they keep going. In fact, they've been found as far down as 20 miles, and oil companies have to be careful not to get oil contaminated by microorganisms because they'll eat the oil. And they are doing amazing work underground all the time. And in fact, you know, we talk about standing on solid earth, and I always thought of earth as this big rock covered with this little fringe of soil just hurtling through space. But what we're really standing on is something that's much more like a coral reef. It's something that's extremely porous, and it's full of air pockets and little pockets for water and little creatures, many, many, many little creatures. And so everything that we want to have happening above the soil, you know, with the world that we actually inhabit, it depends on that work that's going on underground. So I want you to share my sense of wonder about the soil, but I also want you to share my sense of hope, because I think probably anybody who pays attention to news about the environment feels pretty depressed. You know, it's like the news is so unrelentingly difficult and grim. You know, I never had any doubts about the global warming predictions and prognostications, but it was, you know, that's a pretty terrible thing to be convinced of, especially when you look around and you see that we're also driving cars. And I had to do an article once about burning coal mines, and so I was down in West Virginia and Southern Ohio, and you know, we all talk about how terrible fracking is, but coal mines are so horrible. You know, so those are still running, and the coal mine fires that got started, they're still burning, and you know, just an awful lot of things are still sending carbon dioxide emissions up into the air. So, you know, when you know all that and you're following the global warming science, it's hard not to be depressed. But for the first time, I was not depressed because, you know, what we have all been missing as humans and as scientists for a really long time is the role of soil, the role of that down under world modulating and moderating things that are going on above ground. So we're part of this big system, and the soil is very much a part of it. I had always heard people say that the soil is alive, and kind of thought of like bugs and moles and worms and stuff like that as being the life that was in the soil. But it's really, those are like the leviathans. Those are the big great blue whales of the soil. You know, the really important things in the soil, as in the sea, the really important things in the soil and in the sea are the tiniest, tiniest things that we can't see. Those tiny, tiny bacteria and fungi and protozoa and nematodes and microarthropods. This whole community of microorganisms that are in the soil. And people have known about them for quite a while. I mean, it's not that they've been unknown until really recently. You know, when microscopes were developed and people started looking at all sorts of stuff, then they could see that everything is sort of wiggling with life. So people have known that these things were in the soil, but it's really fairly recent information as to what they're doing there and how important they are. And I think that for me it's very similar to what we know now about the human microbiome. You know, we've been, up until maybe the last 5 years, and probably some people are still doing it, you know, we've been going into grocery stores and squirting antibacterial stuff on our hands, and we've been so worried about germs and but, you know, all the recent research shows that we are a ship of microbes. We are, there's one human cell to every, or one, there are 10 bacterial cells to every one human cell in our body. And we have, I think it's 100 trillion microbes in our body, many different species. And there was one of the scientists that I had interviewed for my book, who, you know, these people are so interesting that I can't stop talking to them. So I'm always like sending them an email and saying, can you explain something new to me? And so I asked him, you know, we were talking about the comparison between all these microorganisms in the earth and the human microbiome, which we would not be able to function without. I mean, it regulates our immune system, it regulates our metabolism, it regulates our neurological function. I said, are they the same microbes? Is it the same microorganisms? And he said, we are 90% sure that they are. So we have that incredible, you know, we are covered with microorganisms. The earth is, the surface of it is, it goes way down in the soil. We're all connected by that hidden community that we're just really starting to understand. And so when I was starting to work on this book, since I have written about a lot of different things, people are always saying to me, well, what are you working on now? And so I was walking around saying, I'm working on a book about soil. And I could see everybody kind of going, oh, that's the most boring thing you've ever worked on. And my ex-husband, who's always very blunt, asked me what I was working on. I said, I'm working on a book about soil. And he said, oh, do you always want to be unsuccessful and obscure? So I thought, okay, I have to come up with a better way of explaining this. And so I worked, okay, I'm working on a book about the partners, the ancient partnership between soil microorganisms and plants that humans have interfered with to our detriment, and that pioneers and innovators are trying to repair that partnership or not interfere with it. And so I thought that was somewhat better. It sounded, you know, ancient partnership, a little more like Dan Brown, a little less like, I don't know, somebody who's in the dead book stacks. So that partnership. So the way that partnership goes is that plants, as we all learned years ago, conduct photosynthesis, and they use sunlight, and they take carbon dioxide out of the air, and they use water, and they break apart the carbon dioxide, they toss the oxygen back out there for us to use, and they create a carbon fuel from that carbon dioxide, and they use that to grow. But up to 40%, so here's where the partnership comes in, up to 40% of that carbon fuel they shoot down to their roots, and it goes out through their roots to feed soil microorganisms, which sort of cluster around the roots, just eating away at those carbon sugars and carbohydrates and proteins that the plants are making. And in return, the soil microorganisms are bringing plants things that they can't get. They're bringing plants minerals that they've liberated from rock. So there's that trade going on there all the time. It's a little more complicated than that, but it's basically that's the trade. And it kind of takes, you know, as Hillary Clinton said, it takes a village. It's got this village, or more like a booming metropolis, around the roots of every plant, this booming metropolis of microorganisms taking the carbon sugars, eating each other, excreting the carbon in their poop. And so as scientists often like to say, and I just love it because it's so adorable, they're down there making a living. They're down there making a living. They're creating habitat for themselves. They're creating houses and apartment buildings and swimming pools and, you know, all the stuff that we like.
Stay tuned for more from author Kristen Olson. Her new book is The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. We'll pick up with author Kristen Olson again as she continues her explanation of how microorganisms in the soil function.
They're creating shelter with that carbon glue. They're taking like a piece of sand and a piece of silt and a tiny little piece of leaf and gluing it together with this glue to make places to hide so that other microorganisms won't eat them, and to, you know, create pockets of water in the soil and to create pockets of air, because they need all the same things we do, you know, food and air and water. And that's how that coral reef structure gets in the soil, and it's immensely, immensely important for plants in so many ways. It gives their roots space to move around. It holds water in the soil. So that's been the deal for billions of years. And that carbon, so when back when the guy, the chef told me that these guys are called carbon farmers because they're trying to build up the amount of carbon in the soil. So one of the things that we don't realize, I mean, we sort of think that, you know, modern humans, we're just so terrible that we've created this overload of carbon in the atmosphere just since the Industrial Revolution, that in the last couple of hundred years, we've been so terrible, we've just screwed up the atmosphere. But actually, people have been adding excess carbon dioxide to the atmosphere ever since agriculture began, because all that carbon, the soil can be a very dense, rich sink of carbon. But when people started agriculture, they 10,000 years ago, they started liberating that carbon from the soil through a number of ways. Through the way, by domesticating animals and changing the way animals move over the land, by burning down forests to create farmland, and by plowing. You know, when people started to rake up the soil to plant their seeds, and especially as that became more and more sophisticated, you know, from gouging in the earth with sticks to getting oxen to pull a plow to the behemoth tillers that exist now. Every time the soil is gouged open like that, carbon is liberated. It turns back into carbon dioxide. So we have sent so much carbon up into the atmosphere since agriculture began that one scientist has estimated that we have liberated or released 80 billion tons of carbon into the air through agriculture. And another scientist that I talked to in the book said that ancient people started to change the climate and the atmosphere so much through agriculture that we should have had another ice age 2,000 years ago, but the climate was too warm for it. So all that carbon that's in the air from the beginning of agriculture and from forest fires burning and now from the modern era where we're building, you know, burning gas and coal and natural gas and all the things that we do, all that is called the legacy load of carbon dioxide. So it's up there. And this is the problem. It's up there. And even if we stopped doing all the things that we're supposed to stop doing, if we shut down the coal plants and stopped driving cars and stopped fracking and stopped doing all that stuff, it would still be there. It would dissolve. It would break down in a couple of thousand years, but we don't have that much time. So there are a lot of sort of techno whiz kid people who are out there coming up with, like, very, very elaborate machines and technology, and very, very expensive machines and technology to try to suck carbon dioxide out of the air and store it way down underneath the earth. But the thing is that we already have those things, and they're called plants. You know, plants do that, and it's free, and it's perfectly functioning technology, and it's been, you know, going on since just about the beginning of time. And so can we use plants? So plants, I love to think of plants as a sort of like conduit between heaven and earth. You know, that plants are the avenue, they're the tunnel for the excess carbon dioxide, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to pass through the plants and go down to the soil and stay down there in the soil where that carbon is actually a beneficial thing. So a soil scientist named Ratan Lal was the first one not to notice the connection between degraded land and degraded skies, but he was the first one to really start talking about it and proposing that as a solution, proposing using land management plants to remove carbon dioxide from the air and get it back down into the soil. So he's been, you know, he discovered this link early in his career when he was working in Africa and trying to develop ways to help people there farm more sustainably, because the pattern that they had was to burn down a piece of forest and farm that land for 5 or 6 years intensively, and then the land would just be no good, so then they would move on to another piece of forest and burn it down and do the same. So people had been doing that for thousands of years, but now there were a lot more people and a lot less forest, so he was trying to help them figure out ways to change that. And while he was there, he was looking at all this degraded, you know, this dead, degraded soil, which he hadn't been able to figure out how to help them do things differently. And he was talking to a very famous climate scientist who was there visiting, supposedly to see the success of his project, only it had failed. And so the climate scientist said, "Where do you think all that carbon has gone?" So Ratan Lal was standing there saying, "Oh, that soil, I know that the soil over there in the forest is full of beautiful carbon, but look at that soil, it's just bereft." And so the climate scientist said, "Well, where do you think all that carbon is gone?" And Ratan Lal said, "I don't care, I just want to put it back." And the climate scientist said, it's up there. So he caught that there was this link, you know, that there was this link. And he kind of has been going around ever since then proselytizing about changing our agriculture so that we can get that carbon back in the soil. So it was great talking with him, but it was, you know, so I traveled, I talked to a lot of people, and I traveled to a lot of places when I was working on this book. I went to Australia to talk to some really interesting farmers there, and I went to Zimbabwe to talk to some real pioneers and innovators in grazing there. But my very favorite place in the whole world was North Dakota, where there was this incredible rock star farmer named Gabe Brown. And I got to know him because I had met, at a conference, I had met this young worker for the National Wildlife Federation, and he had this great job, this great enviable job, and the National Wildlife Federation had decided that of all the threats to wildlife, that climate change was the most distressing, the most damaging. And so it was, and knowing that a lot of the carbon dioxide emissions, a lot of the greenhouse gases come from agriculture, knowing that, they had given this guy, Eliev Bitton, the job of going around the country and meeting with farmers to see which farmers had the best practices of, you know, maintaining healthy land and not contributing to the problem, and maybe even making it better. So he had gone, he was going all over the country looking for farmers to profile for this report about future-friendly farming. And so he had gotten to know Gabe Brown, and he told me he was just like the most rock star, ahead of everybody in the country farmer. So, and the reason I mean, I really like Gabe Brown. I just like him. I just like him. But the reason I really love his story is that, I mean, I go to my farmer's market with, you know, religious fervor and buy all my meat and vegetables and just about almost everything I eat there. And I love the farmers at my farmer's market, but, you know, one of them was a microbiologist before. A couple of them were philosophy majors at one point. A lot of them are really young. Somebody said to me the other day, "Oh, there are so many young people doing such great things, and they don't even care if they're getting paid." And that is wonderful, except that nothing will change if it's only people who are doing something because they have youth and energy and don't care if they're not getting paid. The reason I love the story of Gabe Brown is that he went into agriculture not because he thought he was going to save the world or change the climate or anything, but because he was going to make money. And he hadn't been the son of farmers, which a lot of people in North Dakota are, but he hadn't been the son of farmers. His uncle was a farmer, and he always really liked farming, so he thought he would enjoy farming. But he, you know, he wanted to make a good living. And he went to ag school, and he did, you know, so when he started off as a farmer, he started off with the whole ag school playbook of, you know, plowing and spraying and all the stuff that you're taught there. And he did all right for a couple of years, and he was a really far-sighted and thoughtful guy right from the very beginning. And so one of the things that he changed, he did deviate from the program a little bit, because he went from a tilling farmer to a no-till farmer. And no-till farming, it still utilizes equipment, but it makes, instead of making a big deep furrow in the soil, it makes a little slit. It's a machine that tries to disturb the land as little as possible so as not to volatilize that carbon that's in the soil. So he had noticed that his land just seemed much, much drier when he tilled. So he decided to stop doing that. But then he had his, like, biblical bout with nature. It seems to me it was biblical. 4 years he had his, all his crops were killed. Once by hail, once by drought, once by something else. I don't know. I mean, I don't remember. But 4 years in a row, he had no crop to take to market. And he was desperate. He just wanted to be able to hang on to his farm. And so, you know, one of the things that he did, because he was just trying to save money, and he sent his cattle into his fields to eat these ruined crops, you know, instead of getting out there with a machine, and instead of ordering food from someplace else for the cows, he put those two things together, and he would just march his cattle through the fields to eat these ruined crops. And he started planting cover crops, too, on fallow land, on land that wasn't planted, just to protect the soil against erosion. And he didn't really think it was... And that's a practice that people in agriculture have done for a long time. They plant cover crops. It's not a crop they're going to take to market, but it just protects the soil from the wind and the rain and all that. And he didn't realize that there was anything more to it than that. But he started, after a while, to realize that his land, his soil was seeming healthier. His land seemed to be more resilient. He seemed to be doing better with his crops than the people around him. And he kind of thought that the crisis was over, and he really, you know, he could go back to using chemicals and all that. But he had struck up a friendship with a soil scientist who was really, her name is Chris Nichols, and she's now the head of the Rodale Institute. She's the head scientist for the Rodale Institute. But then she was a USDA soil scientist, and she just was really in the forefront of those scientists who were starting to look in the soil and try to figure out what those relationships were between those different soil microorganisms and what actually they were doing there in the soil and how they were beneficial to agriculture. And she said, nah, you know, don't go back to the chemicals right away. Let's see what we can do. And so between the two of them, they really decided to try to see if he could achieve all the effects on his farm without chemicals, just by relying on things in nature, by these laws of nature that they were just starting to understand better. So he didn't go back to chemicals. He realized, you know, he and Chris realized that the best fertilizer that his crops were getting really was the roots going, you know, that action of the roots going, of plants going into the ground and shooting down carbon sugars and feeding those soil microorganisms that are going to come and bring minerals. That, you know, if you look in nature, if you look at something that's just growing like crazy out in the woods or out in a meadow, things are growing very well without fertilizer. They don't need, there's a natural fertilizing process that's just going on there. So he realized that that maybe they could just keep up that fertilizing process by planting everything really densely in his cornfield. So he started planting not only cover crops when the fields were fallow. He never really had let the fields go fallow again. They were always covered with some kind of vegetation. So he wanted to always have roots going in the ground to nourish those soil microorganisms. So even when he planted his rows of corn, he would plant cover crops going up the middle there. So there was always a really diverse, dense mix of vegetation in his fields. And that's a really, I don't know how many cornfields you've seen, but that's a really big, when I moved from Cleveland out to Portland, I, you know, drove out with my two dogs. And I always used to love the sight of all those cornfields along the side of the road, you know, just that sort of beautiful symmetry, you know, the corn and then the brown dirt between them and the corn. Of course, now I look at that and I think, abomination. But he really changed that. Instead of having that bare soil between there, he's got this diverse mix of cover crops. And diverse, you know, because that's another thing in nature. In nature, there is never a monoculture. There's never just one thing growing. There's always, even when you see an area that looks like, well, there's a lot of things growing, there's a lot of that one thing growing there. There's always a lot of things growing there. I think he had somebody come and count the plants that were in a square foot of the prairie near on one of his fields where his cattle graze, and I think that there were 40 different plants growing there. So he started really changing the way his farming looked, changing the way he did it. He had these cover crops going between the rows of corn. He was still sending in his cows at the end of the harvest to munch everything down and stomp everything down. And he continues to this day to not use any of those chemicals. A little bit of herbicide, which he's trying to eliminate, and he's trying to figure out how completely to eliminate that. But he uses no fertilizers, he uses no pesticides, he uses no fungicides, he doesn't have the tags in the cow's ears that keep away flies or whatever it does. And the thing that's really so impressive about his results, I mean, his results can be measured in a number of ways. I mean, one way is just economic. He doesn't, so he, in the county where it's a big corn and commodity corn, commodity wheat, it's a big agricultural county. I mean, it's probably all agricultural where he farms. And he's right in the middle of the county average, he's right at the county average in terms of yield per acre. So he doesn't have as much, many bushels of corn coming off an acre, say, as the person who's dumping on a load of fertilizer for the first time, you know, when they really get a big bump of productivity. But what he does have, so he's right in the middle there. But he makes more money than anybody else does because he's not spending all that money on fertilizer and pesticides and fungicides. So that's one way. That's one way to look at how he's been successful. He's more financially successful than the people around him. And you know, there's been this rule of thumb in American farming since the Nixon years of get bigger or go under. You know, plant hedgerow to hedgerow. You know, plant everything you can and get big and expand or die. And he has sort of turned that on its head. He's been so successful financially that he's gotten rid of acreage. He's given up fields that he used to rent. He's gotten smaller because he knows that his success is really coming from managing the land well and working with nature rather than just growing more and more and getting bigger and bigger. So that's one way to measure his success. Another way to measure his success is North Dakota gets, I think, 15 inches of rain a year. It's a really, really dry area. He doesn't need to irrigate. He doesn't need to irrigate because all that coral reef structure that I talked about, you know, it goes way down in the soil. So when he was showing me around his farm, he was walking around with this long metal rod, this 4-foot long metal rod, and he was sort of waving it around and, you know, pointing to this flower that was growing there and this insect that was hopping around here. And then we were walking in his cornfield, and all of a sudden he bent over and he shoved it straight down into the ground, all the way down to his knuckles, 4 feet straight down. And if you've ever had a garden, you'll know that that is really extraordinary. I mean, I've had, you know, beds in my yard that I have tended lovingly with compost and all sorts of other things over the years. I've never, ever had soil that was anywhere near like that. And so what's happening, the reason he's able to shove that in is that there's that incredible coral reef structure going on under his soil. It's extremely friable. So he doesn't need to worry about irrigating when, you know, they don't get a lot of rain. But what matters the most to somebody, to the land, is not actually how much rain you get. I mean, that's an issue. But if the soil is sick and there isn't that coral reef structure in there and it's compacted, what happens when the rain comes down is that rain just rolls away. It might soak into the first half an inch, but it just rolls away and it rolls downstream and it goes into the, you know, it goes into the streams and lakes and sort of carries some sediment with it and is a pollutant. But when your soil is like his is, that that water goes down into the soil and it stays there, and it can keep those, it waters those crops for weeks and weeks and weeks, even if you don't get rain. So one of the other ways of looking at the health of his soil is that when he first started working that land, he had a test done on it to see, to look at how quickly water percolates into the soil, which is a sign of health. You know, it should have all those, if it has all those little holes in it, the water will percolate down, it'll stay there, it won't run off. So when he first started, his soil, his land, only would, it took, in an hour, only a half an inch of water would go down into it. So now, in an hour, 8 inches of water will percolate down into the soil. So that's just huge, 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 huge.
Coming up, author Kristen Olson continues the story of farmer Gabe Brown's experiments with low-impact farming. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome back to the last segment of tonight's Speakers Forum with Kristen Olson on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Here Olson continues the story of farmer Gabe Brown's success with carbon farming.
So what he's done there, he's just created this system where the food is better because it's getting, see, it seems to me that it's, and all the testing on whether food that's been raised this way or food that's raised in a conventional system, it's not a lot of good testing that's been done on that. But if you think about in nature how plants get fertilized, how plants get nutrients from this vast, vast community of soil microorganisms, but then in conventional agriculture, they're dumping on basically just three nutrients. And what happens when they dump on those three nutrients, nitrogen, potassium, and what's the other one? They dump on those three nutrients, and it kind of shuts down that relationship between the plants and the soil microorganisms. The plant stops sending out carbon sugars to that community of soil microorganisms, and they kind of go away or die or just get dormant. So if you think about how you want your food fertilized, you want that full congregation of microorganisms to be bringing all those elements that are out there, you know, some of which maybe science hasn't even identified yet. So he's developed something where his plants are getting that full cluster of microorganisms and nutrients, and the water around him is cleaner because instead of running off, it's sinking down into the soil, and the air is cleaner because the soil is hanging together, not blowing away. The farm is more productive. It's just like an amazingly good example for agriculture in so many ways, and I think the reason, again, that his example is so important, I think, is it shows that somebody can make a good living with that kind of agriculture, and somebody can make good food with that kind of agriculture. I think we're always given a false dichotomy, and I've heard people who should know better, say, oh, yes, organic farming is so good. Organic food is so good. It would be so nice if everybody could have that. But there are too many of us. We need mainstream conventional agriculture because they're the ones who can make the bulk. And it's just a false dichotomy because a really well-managed farm like that can create as much food, and it's going to be better food than all these horrible mega farms. So I just want to end with a quote from this guy, somebody I interviewed for the book. His name is Peter Donovan, and he started something called the Soil Carbon Challenge, and he's living in a yellow school bus, and he'll be there for many years. He's riding around the country in this yellow school bus and working with farmers and ranchers around the country in something called the Soil Carbon Challenge. So what happens is that these farmers and ranchers say they want to be part of the challenge, and the challenge is who can build up the most amount of carbon in their soil in 10 years. So he takes a baseline measurement, and then he comes back in 5 years, and then he comes back in 10 years, and whoever has done it the most gets the money in the pot. So he's just a really brilliant, thoughtful guy. And so I told him, I had interviewed him in person. I had gone to a farm where he was doing the measurements, and then I stayed in touch with him. And at a certain point, I told him that that I was just so amazed. All these soil health people that I was talking to around the world, that they were so optimistic, that they were so just optimistic. And everybody else I knew was so depressed about the environment and nature. And I asked him why he thought that was, why he thought they were so optimistic. And he said, it's because they're connected to the most powerful geologic force, which is life. Most of what we take to be the physical environment is the creation of living organisms over time. That's a different paradigm than the idea that life is a fragile passenger on a dead planet. So I just love that we're not a fragile passenger on a dead planet. We have powerful allies to help us sort out the damage that we've done to the environment, to help us remediate the damage that we've done to the environment. And they're in the soil, and they're probably all around us too, but in the soil, let's focus on the ones in the soil. And we're understanding more about what they do and what they can do all the time. And lots of us, you know, it's not just farmers and ranchers who have some impact on this. You know, most American homeowners have lawns. We all have spaces that we have some influence over, and we also have an influence on agriculture as a whole by the food that we buy and the way that we tell our elected representatives to use our tax dollars. So, you know, not that it's going to be easy, because there are really very powerful vested interests that, you know, are supporters of the agricultural system that we have now. But consumers have already been able to change some of that, and we can just keep changing it. At a certain point when I was working on the book, I was really dissatisfied with the title, because I thought, oh, who's going to want to read a book called The Soil Will Save Us? So I was trying to think of a sexier title. I had a poet friend working on it. She didn't come up with anything. So anyway, at one point I thought, Heroes of the Underground. I like that. Then I called up my editor, and she was like, no, we're not going to call it that. Nobody will know what you're talking about. But I still love that idea that there are heroes of the underground, that the soil microorganisms are heroes of the underground, and I think all of us can be heroes of the underground working with them. So anyway, be hopeful. I'm feeling very hopeful. There's a scientist, David Johnson, and I talked to him, and he's featured in the end of my book, and he was the one I had to call the other day just to talk, and he's the one who said that he thought that 90, you know, they're pretty sure that the microorganisms in the soil are the same ones that are in us. And he is doing research in New Mexico, you know, working with things like cover crops and no-till, and he's doing this intensive cover cropping and new planting and working with compost. Anyway, the results that he's seeing in his soil are just astounding in terms of the amount of carbon that he's building there. And he said, and this is new research, and I'm sure it's going to come under attack, but he said that according to the numbers that they're seeing there, that if 11% of the world's cropland, and apparently 11% of the world's cropland is not even in use every year, but if 11% of the world's cropland would engage in these kind of really intensive carbon-building practices, that land, that 11%, could absorb all of the carbon dioxide emissions from human activity in a year, every year. So it's pretty astounding research.
I'm just curious as if you've had a chance to get out to like Washington State University, to the land grant colleges that teach our farmers, professors, ag professors, researchers in the academic arena know about your book?
Some individuals are very excited about it. The great difficulty is that our public funding of university research has really dropped in the last 20 years, and private funding has really moved in. So it's very, the money that's available for university researchers is to work on Monsanto and Cargill and, those kinds of projects. So it is difficult for a lot of these scientists who are moving in other directions to get the research funds. And even when they do get the research funds, like in my book, there's a researcher, I think at Iowa State or University of Iowa, who has done a lot of really remarkable research on, it's not going to come to me now, but a lot of really remarkable research just with this kind of work, low technology, nature's low technology, working with nature to sort of change things and enhance those natural partnerships between plants and soil microorganisms and animals. And he had some really astounding results. And the university just ignored him. They never promoted his results. They never called attention to his results. So even when those researchers do find the money to do some really amazing research, those universities are really beholden to their private benefactors. So it's tough. It's tough. But individually, I think there are a lot of scientists at the ag colleges who, especially the young ones coming in, who really want to. There's a plant breeding specialist at, I guess it's Washington State, that I was interviewing for an article recently, and he said, "Oh yeah, here everybody's into organic and sustainable, and especially the young people." So I think that is changing, but there still is this stumbling block of funding.
I heard that on the prairies, historically, the root systems of all the grasses, prairie grasses and things, they can go down just, incredibly numbers. And is there a parallel to what we can do in our own home landscapes? Because other than planting prairie grass that goes down,
Absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to do that. When I'm working on my garden, it's kind of like, what would Gabe Brown do? So the three bywords that I sort of pay attention to is like dense. You want as much as possible. You want the soil covered by a dense mat of vegetation. You don't want bare soil. You don't want a lot of gravel. I swear landscape designers are in love with gravel, but it does nothing for the soil. So you want as many roots in the ground as possible. And so that means, in a home garden, so what Gabe Brown has going, he has corn and he has all these diverse cover crops growing between, but people who are trying to do it for beauty as well as function, they're trying to have a large thing, but then like gradually smaller understories of things under that. So it is possible. And I do talk about that in the book, about having this one head of an arboretum was telling me, he tries to have a really dense mixture of varied things in there, so not only dense but diverse, because those soil microorganisms want a diverse diet. I mean, if you think about it, nature really hates a monoculture. So one of the reasons that farming is so hard, that farmers who are farming in a conventional way where they've just got corn, or soy. One of the reasons that they are always fighting against pest and disease is that nature tries to destroy a monoculture. Nature tries to restore balance by sending in disease and insects. So when you have diverse things growing there, it not only attracts diverse insects, it not only attracts a really healthy insect population that that includes predators who will kill pest insects, but it's, you know, that diverse mixture of plants is really feeding our soil microorganisms very, very well. So dense and diverse and undisturbed. I remember back when I first started gardening, and it seemed like all the books were telling you to dig 2 feet down and dump that or mix something in, and it was so arduous. And now I just like make the tiniest little opening in my soil that I possibly can and put in a seed or a plant and cover it up right away. So I have a new garden, and I've been trying to get as many plants going as I can, but you know, that's a little slow getting things to spread and fill out. So if you don't have plants to put there, just a lot of mulch. Mulch is good. Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to Kristen Olson, the author of The Soil Will Save Us. In his review of Olson's book, environmentalist Bill McKibben said, "On the long list of things we have to do to fight climate change, learning to pay attention to soil again is near the top. It's not just dirt. It's not just something that holds plants upright. As this book points out, it's pretty damned vital." Kristen Olson spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 28, 2014. Thanks to Anna Tadashev for this recording. If you enjoyed tonight's talk, you'll find it and many more on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. We post each new episode on the Friday following the broadcast. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.